Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Johnny Carson once interviewed Bette Davis and asked if she had any advice for young starlets wanting to get ahead in Hollywood. She suggested take Fountain. Fountain Avenue runs parallel to Santa Monica and Sunset Boulevards in Hollywood and is often used to avoid the heavier traffic. And isn't that what we're all after? A smooth run, no hold-ups, not only in traffic, but also in life. How do people handle those hold-ups, the rejections? How do they create a life in the entertainment capital of the world? How do they identify and express their uniqueness in a place where hundreds of thousands are hoping to do the same? Welcome to Take Fountain. Compelling stories from passionate people who've made it, are making it, in Hollywood. Writers, comedians, actors, filmmakers. I'll talk to anyone with a story to tell.
Welcome to Take Fountain, a podcast of passionate people working on their dreams. Compelling stories from Hollywood. Your host, Ella James.
My guest today is Roy Seacoff, the author of Lax Self-Control, True Stories I Waited Until My Parents Died to Tell. But Roy and I actually met about 5 years ago now.
No, it was the spring of 2015.
You even that's amazing.
Yes.
So I voiced something for you for HuffPost Live.
Yeah.
Which you were running at that stage.
Yes, we did. It was a spin-off of that. It's called HuffPost Show.
Right.
And it was basically an hour-long show, kind of like The Daily Show or John
yes.
Oliver.
Yeah.
Sort of our dipping our toe in the late-night comedy world.
Right.
Yeah.
So my claim to fame was that I was on the same episode as the late Florence Henderson.
Yeah, what a sweet lady.
Right.
What a sweet lady.
That
was a great episode. There was some really funny stuff in that.
Yeah.
You know, because she was so good to go. I don't know if you want to talk about this, but she was so good to go, you know. I was laying in bed, and I think this was Thursday morning,
mm-hmm.
and we did the show live Friday night.
Yeah.
And I was laying in bed, and I was thinking, man, we've got Florence Henderson. And right at that time, I don't know if you're an American sports fan, but Tom Brady, who's the quarterback of the New England Patriots, there was the big thing called Deflategate. And there was this big thing about whether he had shrunk the size of the footballs that he used in the championship game. It was this big outroar. And he had done a press conference that was ridiculous because all he talked about was his balls. And it was just this constant talking about his balls. And it was very, very funny. And I was laying in bed.
Do you mean he's not that smart?
No.
Great.
And that's what made it so funny.
Yeah.
And so I was laying in bed and I thought, you know, that's interesting. And then it hit me. Brady. I have Carol Brady. Her role on the Brady Bunch. I said, Brady, I've got to have the real Brady news conference with her talking about balls and grabbing balls and holding balls and touching balls and balls. And so I thought, oh, and she kind of liked being a little saucy.
Yeah.
She was
She
was kind of like the Betty White, you know.
Oh, and she was almost, I mean, she was like the R-rated Betty White.
Yeah.
Right?
And so she liked being like the frisky octogenarian,
yes.
you know. And so I wrote up this little sketch where basically she comes out as Tom Brady, dressed the same way, everything the same, and she just talks about her balls, how much she likes balls, and everybody knows I like big balls. I don't like my balls because he supposedly made the balls smaller, easier to hold.
Right.
She likes her balls big as you can get them. And so I wrote this little, you know, double entendre filled silly thing and sent it to her manager, and he said, "Love this, great. When do you want to do it?" I said, "Well, you know, can you come in tomorrow?" Early before, you know, we went live at 6 p.m.
Yeah.
Can you come in like at 11 in the morning? She came in and we did a great, perfect green screen that looked exactly the same hat, everything the same. And she killed it. And she was so funny and I just adored her, you know. And then she invited me to come see her the next night, she was doing some, you know, Broadway fundraiser.
Mm.
The average age of the performer was 112. You know, it was like all these very, very old Broadway performers. And they were not that great. She killed it.
Yeah.
She absolutely crushed it. And it just, it devastated me when she died, just, you know.
Well, it was very, very close
within
to
a
that.
Year. Within a year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so sad. She was so lovely and so much fun.
With your writing, Would you characterize yourself, I mean, clearly you are, you're an author now, but would you characterize yourself as a writer from a career perspective? Is that the primary thing, or what are you?
Yeah, what am I? That's
what
a good question.
You?
That's a really good question.
What are you having for lunch, and what do you want to do for the rest of your life?
Exactly.
The big ones.
I can lay it all out. Existential truths coming at you. Let's go back. Let's flash back, and we'll bring this question around, a circuitous route. So, as I mentioned in the book, in the opening of the book, as I talk about what led me to write the book, I've said that while researching some of these stories, I went back and found a trove of report cards that my mother had kept. And I found one from nursery school. So when I was like 4 years old. And the teacher's comment was, Roy has a delightful sense of humor that is enjoyed by all, including his teacher. Then I found my first grade report card, 7 years old, and it said, Roy enjoys creative writing and should be encouraged to do more. And so if you look at it, by the age of seven, I was a funny writer.
Yes.
And yet it took me 40 years of existential angst to figure out what the hell I should be doing.
Are you kidding me?
Well, you know, I mean, I always wrote.
I always wrote.
But, you know, I didn't identify myself this way or that way necessarily. I started writing poetry very young and got attention for that. I remember in fifth grade I was asked to read my poem about racial tolerance in front of the whole school. And then I wrote a poem about the Vietnam War, because I'm a child of the 60s.
Yeah.
And technically the 50s, I was born in 1959, but I grew up in the 60s.
Yes.
And so I wrote a poem about the Vietnam War and got a lot of attention for that. And I was actually asked to come and speak at a college creative writing class as a 13-year-old, sort of demonstrate creative expression and what they should be doing, you know. So I always did that. And then I got a little bit older and discovered performing and sort of went in that direction for a while.
Mm. Was that stand-up or acting?
Well, this was like early school plays.
Okay, right.
You know, I remember I got very lucky. I was in a drama class. It all started actually in sixth grade when Mr. Berchansky, who was my sixth grade teacher, they were having a talent show. And I had no discernible, demonstrable talent. You know, by that I mean I couldn't sing.
You weren't a singer, dancer.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't play any instruments.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh yeah, I'm gonna do that. I wasn't a gymnast. But he came up to me and he said, Seekoff, you never shut up. Maybe we can put that to good use. Do you want to be the MC of the talent show? So I thought, okay. You know, and so basically I introduced acts and sort of just did shtick in between. Like, it wasn't prepared shtick, it was just, I came back and just made funny comments about what the person had just done.
Right.
Or, you know, something like that. I remember one time very specifically, I remember this one act, it was a girl, and she was a gymnast. And she did all kinds of hyper-limber stuff, you know, bending over backwards and touching her head to her feet. And I just kind of came out and I did like a Carson, you know, just a, all right then. And it got a huge laugh. You know, and I was like, okay, that's good.
It's that kind of reward is addictive.
Oh my God.
Right?
Oh.
Was there a point in your career where you realized that actually wasn't what you were after?
Yeah. So basically I did that. So all through high school, you know, I was the president of Thespians, you know, the drama club and all the stupid jokes that came along with that. You're a thespian.
Yeah, right.
Yes, I like girls. Oh. Very funny. You know, moronic seventh grade humor. So I did plays and did all that stuff. And then I went to college and started as a drama major. And did very well and got a lot of lead roles at the University of Miami where I went to school. And but it dawned on me that, you know, that seemed a little limiting.
Mm-hmm.
And I always loved films. So I thought, why don't I switch my major from theater to film? And I could become a director and a writer and cast myself in my own movies.
Okay.
Woody Allen at the time was obviously the great glory for all young Jew boy wannabe writer directors, you know. And so he's now been besmirched, but at the time, obviously, Woody Allen, you know, was the gold standard.
Yeah.
So I started taking film, and I loved the freedom, you know, because obviously having come from the theater, you know, you're very much limited to one or two sets. Suddenly you could cut, you could end a scene, you could start, you know, so I loved the idea of that. So I still was doing that. And I actually moved out to Los Angeles. I'm giving you the long version, but I moved out to Los Angeles.
It's a long interview.
Yes.
People are in their cars.
Yes.
Think 405.
Okay. Oh, well, you're stuck in traffic. Yeah. I'm so sorry for you. I feel very bad. We could be like the Californians. Yeah, take the 405, dude. Don't take the 101. Right.
It's my favorite. I digress.
Yes.
Go
but
back.
Anyway, so I came out here to go to USC Film School,
right?
The legendary film school, home of George Lucas and John Milius and all these, movers and shakers of the 70s. And I was doing that. Didn't love the school. Didn't love the experience there. But was sort of, and then a friend of mine had started a magazine, sort of a free giveaway that was sort of half National Lampoon, half Rolling Stone, about comedy. And so he said, you want to help? And I was going to film school. I said, yeah, I'll help. And then I started doing more of that, and I was enjoying the writing of that. And, and then I was actually a pretty decent writer. And so they're like, we need somebody to write up this interview with Robin Williams. And they're like, Roy, you should go because you're the best writer. And I was like, okay. So I went and interviewed Robin Williams, hung out with him for a couple days, and started doing while I was going to film school. And I decided this was more fun than that. At the same time, I was still trying to do a little acting. I'd done some stand-up, you asked. I had won a contest in college, the funniest man on campus. Because I'd never done stand-up. I'd just been an actor. But I love stand-up, and I love Pryor and Carlin and Lenny Bruce. They were all seminal performers. So I did some stand-up and enjoyed it. But there's something about that life that didn't appeal to me. Mm-hmm. I saw it. I saw what it was. I saw that it was, you wait all day for your 10 minutes at the Comedy Store or at the Improv, if you're lucky. Usually it's some hole in the wall. Where are we about cursing?
Oh, cursing's great.
Yeah, so some shithole, which is actually a deli, and they put a microphone up and three people stand. That's really what you're doing, But even the Comedy Store, you wait all day, and then you stay up all night drinking with your buddies, dissecting.
It's not conducive to any kind of healthy lifestyle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I already had the makings of, deep neuroses and anxiety, so that wasn't going to help me, having come from a deeply neurotic family. So, yes, that means Jewish. Yes, Jewish, they're sort of synonymous in some ways.
Oh, what you're saying is very common. Have you seen Hannah Gadsby's Nanette on Netflix?
No.
Okay, you need to watch it, and then we'll email next week.
Okay.
It covers this.
Yeah.
I've just left stand-up. I mean, public announcement, everyone. But I'm doing my last comedy show in July because she wraps everything up into a tight little bow as to the self-deprecation, the self-humiliation, the point of comedy, at what point, that whole getting your therapy by being on stage, and you just think, no.
And I was also, I had the arrogance of youth, which screwed me up in a number of ways, and one of the ways was that I was delusional enough to believe that show business was a meritocracy. So I thought, I'll just do good work, and my good work will lead to my success.
And you're a white male. What could go wrong?
Well, I never really thought about. Well, we didn't have the idea of privilege in those days.
No, I know.
And in fact, I actually found it to be a detriment in some ways.
Yeah.
But by the, I'm obviously wildly privileged in every way you could possibly imagine. Just being born in America. Just being born in this century. Just being born to parents who, everything. So I'm I'm no sad violins for Roy Seacoff at all. But as George Carlin talks about in some of his earlier bits as a comedian, minority cultures or niche cultures give you something very interesting to talk about as opposed to the same shit that, how many funny Jewish guys are there? Oh, none. What a breakthrough. You're the first one we've ever seen, Roy Seacoff. You know what I mean? So, Chris Rock, fantastic. He's certainly in the top 10 of all time, right? Mm. But he gets a lot of mileage out of his rhythm, which is a very preacher, churchy rhythm, when he's stalking around the stage and he's pacing back and forth and he's sort of testifying in some ways, when he's doing his famous bit about OJ, I'm not saying that it's okay that he killed her, but I understand it. It's a very specific rhythm. I couldn't do that rhythm, right? That would be not only wildly inappropriate,
but it also wasn't uniquely you.
Well, correct.
And to find your authenticity,
It's very hard.
It's the meaning of life, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
But yeah.
So it's very hard, you know.
Yeah.
But so Carlin talks about that. You know, there was a period where he felt like he was black, you know, and was on the streets with the guys. He liked doing the dozens. It was much more interesting than his sort of Irish, you know, family background. Mm-hmm. So for me, I felt that, you know, not that I'm Zelig, but I felt like I like to fall in. Like I grew up in a great melting pot place and time. Miami, Florida in the 70s, 60s and 70s. I went to a great melting pot high school, which drew from all these different areas of the town. So we had the Cubans who had settled sort of in Calle Ocho, who had come over, you know, in the first wave. And then we had the African Americans who sort of settled around Coconut Grove. We had the old money WASP people from the old money Gables. We had the Nouveau Riche Jews, and they all went to the same school. Mm. So in seventh grade, I had gone, not intentionally, but this was just the state of affairs in the 60s. It was a segregated school. They all were, right? Every school was segregated. That's just the way it was. There was no integration at the time. This was early 60s, mid 60s.
Yeah.
And then right around fourth grade, we integrated. And, you know.
I am struggling to believe that I'm with somebody of my age who lived through that.
It was very, very light, you know.
Segregation light.
Segregation light. By that I mean, I didn't grow up in a Georgia or Alabama.
I grew up
in Miami, which was...
still, there was a segregation.
Listen, here's what it was. It was the subtle, horrible segregation of the pretend liberals.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, Miami at the time I was sort of New York South. The rest of the state wasn't. The rest of the state was very southern, rednecky. But Miami was, you know, a lot of snowbirds who had moved down.
It was Gloria Estefan.
No, that was later.
Oh, sorry.
This is 60s. No Gloria. Gloria was just a twinkle in her parents' eye. Yeah, probably hadn't even come over from Cuba yet, or they were in the first wave.
Right.
And so then it became sort of New York South and Havana North, and that became Miami, right? But, so it was segregated. And then fourth grade, we integrated the school. You know, some African Americans came in. And then in seventh grade, when I moved to junior high, our designated junior high was sort of, I don't want to use the word inner city, but it was in, you know, sort of the African American part of town.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it would be considered that.
Urban, is that the word?
Yeah, Miami's kind of a weird place because it's such a spread out, like L.A.
Okay.
It's a bunch of suburbias put together. But, you know, it was sort of a less affluent part of town.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the people from my school did not go, even though that's where they were supposed to go.
Really?
They went to private school. Now, I would say 90% of the students from my elementary school did not go to George Washington Carver Junior High, which is where we were supposed to go in seventh grade. And
what was that like for you?
Well, my parents were as you say, they're dead now. That's why
so
I waited.
I can say whatever I like.
No, because that's why I wrote the book.
I'm actually here for a how-to, so go on.
Yeah. And so, you know, they were old school New York Jewish lefty.
Dad ran an educational bookstore.
Textbook store.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And my mom worked there too.
Okay.
They were both, they both gone to law school, both dropped out of law school to run this bookstore, which became very successful for 60 years,
yeah.
You know, servicing the students of the University of Miami and various community colleges. But they were old school lefties, you know, probably socialists, big supporters of unions, big supporters of civil rights, big supporters of
all. It's great to grow up with such strong opinions.
Fantastic. Yeah. No, that's what. I mean, listen, that's what made me whatever I am today is my parents and my older brother. You know, they're all really smart people. And so I would sit around the dinner table. We didn't sit there and watch Wheel of Fortune. We talked. And they would talk about issues of the day. And I would just struggle to keep up because they're really smart people. And, you know, you want a seat at the table. So the only way you're going to get a seat at the table, as the truck rumbles by our beautiful studios here, you know, is to have ideas. And so I became somebody who wanted to have ideas. And so the only way you can get ideas is to read and to get input of information and sort of, you know.
Could you please tell people that on the Twitter sphere today?
Oh, yeah.
The only way to get information is to read.
To have an opinion is to read and to get
information
and to process it, yes,
yeah.
And then move it out and to form it into an idea. And you had to have...
To be informed and to be passionate is to win the game.
Yes.
Really.
And you had to have strong opinions at the dinner table to get your voice heard, but you wanted to run with that crowd.
Yeah.
So that's what sort of made me want to be a guy with ideas and care about it. We're going all over the place here, but basically, I went to Carver.
I hope you don't mind, but I mean, that's what this is about.
I love it. That's how I go.
The podcast isn't called Take Fountain by chance.
Right.
This is what particularly fascinates me is people's journey.
Yeah.
Because particularly for many younger people that I've met and mentored, and I know that this will be the same for you, I'm not assuming, but that when you're young, you have an anticipation that your life is going to follow a very arrow kind of timeline, that you make a decision to do something, ergo you do it, a few little things get in your way, but overall you overcome. And then as you go through life, you learn about things like resilience and hardship and suffering and questioning yourself and questioning others and all of those things, which ultimately make for a great journey.
You are making me laugh only because you are basically taking the words out of my brain and into my mouth. This is something that I talk about a lot.
Yeah.
As you say, we get to a certain place in our lives, you know, and I've been very lucky. So I've been asked to speak in schools and colleges, and I go around, and you know, I have two college-age children as well, and I see a lot of among their peers that there's this very linear view of life.
Mm.
I'm going to go to this school, and I'm going to get this degree, which is going to get me this job, which is going to make me happy, and life is going to work out. Clearly, that's not the truth. There's, as you say, there's trapdoors, there's pitfalls, there's curveballs, there's all kinds of things. And that's why I say that my life, I describe it as a zigzag life. If you chart my career, which we were kind of doing, it's what? And if you had told me literally one day before the Huffington Post was founded, that at some point in the next 5 years, I was going to be the editor of the largest digital news source in the world, I would have said, you're insane. That's not what I do. That wasn't my thing.
So I just want to distill down on that, because we could do the linear thing.
Yeah, no, there is no linear.
Okay. So you have a notion in your head of who Roy Seacoff is. And then you get an offer to be the founding editor of the Huffington Post. Take me through that.
Yeah, well, there's 100 zigzags before that.
Oh, I'm sure there are.
So just basically to give you a quick, I will give you the accordion version, which gets back to what you were asking before, right? At a certain point, I went on a few auditions. So this is my early 20s, still thinking about performing. And I realized this is no, and I say this was all love for my many, many actor friends, this is no life for a sane person. You know, this is not a life for a sane person, because you are judged on the most harsh physical appearance terms on a daily basis, right? It's not like, hey, you know, you're not right for the part. It's like, you're not pretty enough. You're not handsome enough. Your nose is too big. You need to gain some weight and fix your teeth. And you get that fucking every day. This is not a good thing for your sanity, right? And so I realized, hey, I still wanted to be a performer, but I thought, this is not the way I'm going to do this. I'm going to create my own shit. I'm going to write my own scripts. I'm going to direct my own things. I'm going to put myself in it.
So and this is still 30 years ago.
Yeah, this is...
Because they talk a lot about producing your own content now, but this is 30 years
35 ago years
you.
Ago, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I was like, okay, I got smart. I'm not going to do that. Mm. At least when you're writing, you're still being judged, but it's one step removed. We hate your script. It's not we hate you. You know, so I decided performing wasn't for me, and so I started writing, and that took on many forms. I fell into being a freelance journalist for a while. I became a producer at the network that eventually became E. Got into video producing, which was sort of part of why I went to film school. I still liked all that visual stuff and editing, and then I decided to become a screenwriter. And so I had a career as a screenwriter for 8 years, and it was a very good, middle-class career as a screenwriter.
In your book, you talk about a script that you pitched to Seinfeld.
No, that it seems like that, but that actually wasn't what happened. I think I know what you're talking about. You're talking about the script that I put in there?
Yeah.
Yes. I never actually pitched it. I just wrote it. What happened was, one of the stories in the book is about me figuring out what to do with my father's porn collection after he dies.
Yes.
And it reminded me of a thing that had happened to me when a friend of mine, who shall remain nameless to protect the innocent and the guilty, was having his girlfriend move in with him. And he said, I gotta get rid of my porn, but I don't wanna throw it away. Can I give it to you to hold in case it doesn't work out with the girl?
The
keeper of the collection, right. So I thought this was really funny. And coming on the heels of the very famous Seinfeld masturbation episode, The Contest, which is one of the most famous Seinfeld episodes ever, where they're, you know, having the contest, I thought, well, this is right in the same wheelhouse, right? What if some guy, like my friend, asks Jerry to keep his porn collection? But of course, it's much better than the shit that the guy gave me. This is like a genius porn collection.
Yep.
So I wrote an episode of Seinfeld, a spec script, called Keeper of the Collection.
Okay.
But I never showed it to anybody because that was what I was doing in those days. I was doing a lot of things that I never showed to people. Screenwriter for 8 years. And that was, you know, frustrating as hell because nothing got made. And so I felt like an architect.
What were you living off at that stage?
Oh, no, I was making a lot of money. It just never got made.
Really?
Oh, you know, there's the development world.
Yeah.
So I was getting paid quite well, but nothing was getting made. So it's like an architect who only does blueprints.
Oh.
They never make your building.
That must be soul destroying.
It very is.
Did you have those conversations with yourself often that was like, what am I doing?
You mean every day?
Yeah.
Every morning?
Yeah.
Every night? Existential dread? Yes, constantly. Like, what the hell am I doing? Is this what I should be doing? And that's, you know, it's a soul sapping. And I became progressively dumber over the course of the 8 years because you meet executives and they say things like, we get it, but they won't get it. You know, flyover country, the middle America.
Oh,
you know,
don't, I hate it. It's the they.
Yeah, yeah. So,
I want to put them on a bus and send them out to realize that they're just like us.
Yes. And so my first script was really smart, and it was a biting social satire like Network.
Right.
And by the end, I was writing the stupidest, most moronic stuff possible, because that's what the...
That's what
they were asking
they
for.
Wanted,
so, you know, at that time, American Pie had just been a big hit, you know, some guy fucking a pie. And I was like, hey, I could have him fuck a Danish or something, you know, whatever. So I was writing really stupid shit because that's what the business brings you to. You offer them good stuff and they go, we don't want that, but here's this really stupid thing. Would you do that? And so I got progressively dumber and more frustrated. And long story short, I kind of hit a, not a wall, but a little dip. There was a dip in my career, brought on by myself.
And by this stage, you would have been married with one or two?
One, yeah. So what had happened was I had gotten married, and we had had our first child, and I loved it, absolutely adored it. And I just was really enjoying being a dad. And what happened was, as show business being this wonderful, magical, fucked up thing that it is, I got paid for two things I didn't have to do. Okay, so this is, because when you are a screenwriter, you often get step deals.
Okay.
So you owe them three drafts, or you owe them two drafts and a polish, or something like that.
Yeah.
So on one of them, the executive got fired, and nobody there wanted to work on the project anymore, so they paid me for the, because I had the contract, so they just paid me for the second draft, which I didn't have to do. And then there was another one where I was working with an actor, and the actor's movie bombed, and they didn't want to be in business with the actor anymore, so they paid me for that. So I had a nice chunk of change, and I said, you know what? Fuck all this. I'm going to take a break, and I'm just going to hang out with my wife and kid and adore this wonderful time that's never going to be back again, you know? So I took a year off, and I didn't, like, do nothing, but I didn't really. Like, I wrote treatments, or I wrote ideas or outlines.
And of course, the headspace of that is this. In hindsight, we know it's a year off.
Yeah.
But at the time, it's not, it can be an uncertain length or...
I lived my life very much by, I called it living on the come. By that I mean, I was always playing for the next thing,
right.
The bigger thing.
Yes.
So let's say I made, let's just pick numbers. Let's say I made 100,000. So I did the math. I'm spending $10,000 a month. So I've just bought myself 10 months of living and trying to roll the dice,
of course,
on the big thing,
mm-hmm.
right? The big spec script that's going to sell for $1 million and change my life. or whatever the thing is.
Because that's there.
Right. Well, that's the truth of this town. Yeah. This town doesn't live off the people who actually do stuff. This town lives off the dreamers. It's the classes for the people who want to learn to be writers. It's the headshot people. It's all these things. It's
absolutely.
This entire...
That's actually a bigger industry.
Oh, yeah.
Than anything else that's...
And they're dangling... Why, in some ways, Variety loved it, but at the time Variety was like sort of like your dealer, your junkie dealer that was injecting in your veins, because you'd wake up and you'd read, unknown sells script for $1 million, and you go, well, that could be me. And this was the spec.
Why not me?
Right. And this
All
was the
that.
Spec script.
Give me a fridge magnet.
Yes. And this was the spec script era, yeah. Where, you know, people were rolling the dice. Shane Black was selling scripts for $2 million. Joe Westerhouse was selling scripts for $3-4 million, you know, and it was like, this was the game, you know? And so that's how I looked at it. And I was always doing things like that. Came close a couple times. Had a guy on the phone, you know. If so-and-so wants to do it, I'll give you $2 million.
Oh, my God.
And then so-and-so didn't want to do it. He picked something else. And somebody else got the $2 million, you know. Once again, I thought it was a meritocracy. It's not.
But this is when you're writing down lines, like 100 lines. I'm lucky I don't take drugs.
Yes.
I'm lucky I don't take drugs.
And you realize, you know, what you realize, and this is what became ultimately very frustrating to me, was it's an incredibly subjective arena, right? I mean, there's no, this script, that script, there's no objective reality to say this is better than that.
Did you make a decision to move away from it, or did an opportunity to present itself that did that for you?
So what happened was, I always compared it to, I wanted to be a runner who raced against 5 other guys and the fastest guy won, as opposed to an ice skater where the Russian judge kept giving me a 3. You know, it's like, well that's not, you know, that's subjective. It's not objectively who's the fastest, it's who had the artistic interpretation that you, for whatever reason, judged better. Right,
okay.
That's the problem with this business, right? So after my year, as a screenwriter, I had always done one of two things. So you go out and you pitch, right? And they either buy the pitch, which you then write, or they go, you know what, we don't really like that pitch, but we've got this piece of crap that we've already paid for that we would like you to rewrite and make better. And so that was my career. I would do one of these and one of those. And for 8 years, that's what I did. I rewrote scripts, I pitched original ideas, and you know, that's how it worked. And it was always quite good, and I would try to write something for myself, and then if I needed the money or the job, I would take a rewrite job, you know.
You're listening to Take Fountain with Ella James.
Well, after I came back from my year off, the business had changed without me knowing it. And the middle class had sort of been decimated. They were still willing to pay the top dog $1 million a week, because he'd won an Academy Award, so you can't be wrong if you say yes to that. Or the kid just coming out of film school, $75,000. But my quote was around $200,000, and they were like, why would we give him 200? He hasn't gotten anything made, right? And so I came out there pitching again, better stuff than I'd pitched before, stuff that absolutely would have sold the year before, and nothing. And not only was I not selling it, I wasn't getting the, hey, we don't want that, but how about this?
Right.
And that lasted for like 4 or 5 months.
That's scary.
And I started going, hey, that's kind of different. And adding jeopardy to our little drama, my wife was pregnant with our second child, and so we were getting towards the end of my health care.
You'd hit your inciting incident.
Yes, and I needed a job.
Right.
And we were about 8 months pregnant at this point, and I thought, man, I really need a job. So in between this, I'd worked with a bunch of guys. I worked on a TV show called TV Nation with Michael Moore.
Michael Moore. Mm-hmm.
And fantastic experience, and all my buddies had gone out and got jobs and been working at great places, and many of them were telling me, come work with us, you know. But I liked being a screenwriter. I liked working at home as opposed to being in an office. And yeah. But at the time, I needed a job, and they said, hey, you know what? One of them was working for Bill Maher. He said, hey, you know, you should come work, you know, work with Bill. So I said, okay. So I went in and I met them, and they were like, hey, that's great. We want to hire you. You can start in 6 weeks. I said, no, I need a job now. I kind of pushed it to the end here. You know, and they said, well, we have two guys and we're not going to renew their contract, but we have a salary cap. This is it. When they go, you can come in.
Right.
I said, dude, I need some money. My wife's going to have a baby. And they said, well, Ariana Huffington has a project that she would like some help with from a comedy writer and smart person who knows politics and blah, blah, blah. You seem to fit that bill. How would you like to do that? And I said, I don't think I'd like that. Because at the time, I didn't know her. And all I knew was, you know, her husband's Senate run. And so I saw her in a certain way because I didn't know her. As we all put people in little
boxes. Of course we do.
Boxes.
It's easier to assume.
Yeah.
And I'll hold my finger and make a memory of that. Go on.
Yeah. So anyway, I went and met Ariana. And she is the most charming person. And she's just delightful. And we had a two-hour conversation. Nothing to do with the project. We talked about her kids, we talked about my kids, we talked about life, we talked about the world. And at the end of 2 hours, she said, I think this will work. And I said, what will work? I don't even know what we're talking about. And she offered me, you know, basically an 8-week job to help with this project called the Shadow Conventions, which were alternate conventions that were going to be run concurrent to the real political conventions, right. The Democrats and the Republicans. And it was a cool project, and during the day there was speeches and panels and all this, and at night there wanted to be an entertainment component with satire and music and stand-up, and that's what I was going to sort of write and produce. And so I said, oh, okay, let me think about it. And it's like in a movie. I walked out of her house, and the phone rang in my pocket, the cell phone. This was a long time ago, so it was a flip phone. I opened the phone, and it was Bill Maher's team, and they said, look, we're going to get rid of the guys. You can start Monday. So I was like, can I think about it over the weekend? And the thing about working with Ariana was I could work at home, and I wanted to be there sort of for the last month of the pregnancy to help with my son and to, you know, help my wife through the final stages of the pregnancy, whereas I would have to have been in an office, a new job, a new office, new hours.
People.
Never being there, you know, never being home. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to roll the dice. So I called up Ariana and I said, look, make it 12 weeks. Because it was an 8-week thing. Make it 12 weeks. Get me through having the baby and all that. And I'll do it. She said, okay. And that 12 weeks turned into 17 years.
And that's how you became the founding editor.
Well, that's how I became Ariana's partner in crime.
Okay.
And then, you know, Ariana's one of the great pot stirrers, you know, that I've ever met.
Right.
She's got stuff going. She's very dynamic. She's got 5 or 6 things happening. And so I kind of, just after the 12 weeks, she said, you know, we liked each other. She liked working with me. I liked working with her. She had 10 other things going on. And she said, you just want to keep doing it?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah. Because after all those years of showbiz, committees, morons, people saying, you know, we get it, but they won't, Ariana was the opposite. She was like, be as smart as you could possibly be, you know? If I wrote a joke, if I wrote a joke for her that, you know, because she made all these appearances and she was on TV shows all the time, you know, so I'd write lines for her and stuff like that. And I'd go, hey, look, 5% of the people are going to get this joke, but those 5% are going to fucking love it. She'd go, great, let's do the joke, you know?
Right.
She loved that. Be as smart as you can be, the best you can be. You use all of your brain, not small parts of your brain. No pie fucking, you know, necessary, you know?
Yeah.
So I was like digging this, and so I only had to please one person, not a committee of people. Plus, in retrospect, and I say this without any, I don't mean it negatively, I went a little crazy. Because in that first 6 months where I was working with Ariana, we had our second child. I don't know, are you a mom or...
No, don't hold it against me.
Yeah, I don't.
Right.
I don't at all. It was nothing that I ever thought was going to be a badge of honor that I needed. But for me, the second child was really much harder than the first.
Yeah.
Not because of her, not because of the... Just having two. You couldn't divide and conquer. It couldn't be like, you are exhausted, go take a shower, I'll take the baby. Now it's like, well, I got to take the baby, you take the toddler. And it was very difficult. So, had a baby. Had a new job, bought my first house because we didn't have enough room, and my dad had open heart surgery all within 4 months. Those were, any one of those things can kind of blow your
Absolutely.
Mind.
Absolutely, they're at the top.
Right, so you have all four of those at the same time, and I kind of went, okay, the only way I'm going to get through this is if I put my head down and work my ass off and not have all the existential questioning that I have all
Am
the time.
Am I doing the right thing?
Right. Is this right? Should I be doing that?
Yeah,
Should I go back to the screenwriting?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is this right? Is this wrong? Am I walking away from
just
something?
Should I go? Do it.
Just do it. Just put your head down and work.
Right.
Right? So I just put my head down and worked. And then I looked up and a couple years had gone by and I'd kind of gotten used to not living on the come, as we talked about with the screen, because I got
yes.
you know, I got a check every 2 weeks. So I kind of, this is good. You know, I kind of got used to that, right?
Yeah.
I didn't want to go back to the, you know, living on the come life. And then, plus Ariana is a fantastic person to work with and knew everybody. And I thought, you know what, we'll eventually get back around to where I wanted to be. Because Ariana, you know, liked movies, and I thought, well, why don't we write a movie together?
Yes.
And, you know, instead of me being the guy, I could be the guy with you who knows everybody. And, you know, so I thought that was my plan.
Mm.
That was my, and it wasn't a secret plan. She knew that was my plan, you know. We'll do some of that, and we'll do some of that. She was like, great. You see, Ariana's very open to all kinds of things.
Yes.
And so then 2004 happened. Were you here at the time?
No. Writer's strike?
No. George Bush wins re-election, beats John Kerry, and in a very disturbing election, where the war hero was painted as a coward, swift boating, and the coward who basically, you know, was doing drugs and went AWOL and never really reported to duty was the war hero, and somehow this shit worked. Right? And even though the Iraq war was going badly and all, you know, the bad things that had happened, he won re-election. And there was a collective WTF, even though that didn't exist at the time, like what the fuck happened amongst progressives across the country, particularly in Hollywood. And there was kind of this post-mortem period where people were going, how the fuck did that happen? You know? And
sidebar, we're currently saying it today.
Oh, that's
well.
That's another episode. That, we have to take Fountain and Fun. But
All the way.
So anyway, people got together, and one of the things they talked about was that this messaging machines that the Republicans had built over a 30-year period needed to be counteracted, but how could we do that quickly? And the internet, which wasn't new, but was newly rising up as a media force. Howard Dean had raised a lot of money using the internet, and people were like, yeah, the internet could be a way that we could truncate that 30 years into, you know, a shorter period and counteract this messaging machine. And that was the basic fuel that fired the idea of the Huffington Post, what became the Huffington Post. And at that time, you know, we were going to create this news aggregator with a progressive point of view, and Ariana's idea, which was, let's bring all these wonderful people who have great ideas but don't have an online presence.
Yes.
You know, Mike Nichols and David Mamet and Nora Ephron and Larry David. You know, these people didn't have time to be writing. This was before there was no Twitter, there was no Facebook.
Yes,
you know, none of this
crap. I remember.
So now, like in those days, you'd have to write something. Now, you know, it's 140 characters. You know, or now it's 280. But you know, you can. Everybody is their own writer. Everybody's their own.
And everybody has a
their own platform.
Fabulous sense of self-importance.
Yes. So anyway, the idea for the HuffPost came about. And Ariana said, you know, well, you'll be the founding editor. And I said, I don't know if I want to do that. Like, I liked all the stuff. We had just sold a TV show.
Right.
To FX.
Okay.
And we were both going to be co-executive producers. I was going to write it. She was going to be the host. And I said, well, I'll just work on that, you know, because I didn't think the Huffington Post was going to be
well.
Who could?
Who could have known?
And so I said, yeah, you go do that. I'll do the other thing. We'll meet in the middle. You know, she said, no. This is what we're doing, and you'll be the editor, and that's what you're going to do. And I said, I don't want to. And she said, that's okay. You know, I'm going to do it. You're going to do it with me, and that's what we're going to do. And I said, okay. And who knew? Right?
Yeah.
So it was basically four of us. And we started at four people in Ariana's living room. And when I left, it was like 800 people in 16 countries. And most amazing journey, most amazing ride of my life. Fantastic. And you know, super empowering, and not, that's the short version. The long version was, it was a lot of hard work. We busted our ass. We worked at 18 hours a day, many days. We made a lot of right decisions. We were very lucky, as all successful people have to be, you know, at the timing of it and all that stuff. And, you know, 6 years after we launched, we sold the company to AOL for $315 million. And, and then that enabled us to superpower the HuffPost's growth. And then that's when we went international. And then that's what allowed me to create HuffPost Live, which was our live streaming network, which we were doing 60 hours of live programming a week.
Yes.
And that was the best experience of my life for me, because it was sort of something I created, co-created with a guy named Gabe Lewis. I ran it. I was the president of it. I had 100 people working directly under me. And a blast. Just a blast.
It's, the story confirms something that I say a lot, and that is when I was making the decision to come to America, because I literally, after my family died, I went to New York on vacation in 2010 and got discovered by a talent producer from NBC who walked up to me and said, "Who are you? You look like you're someone." And I said, "Well, you know, I'm someone, but..." Like, at that stage, I was the GPS voice in 75% of cars around the world. I'd done radio and TV. I'd just started acting, done a little bit of stand-up. But I followed that, and so, you know, crazily, I moved over here. When I was writing down, you know, because I was not 20, I'm writing down my list of the pros and cons of all the rest of it. And I went back in time to all the major decisions I'd made and what I had to do to achieve the end result. And what I realized was that it was never my decision, it was always a person. You've got to do all the prep work, but it's always someone that steps in. And you've just confirmed
that. Yes, no one tells you. This was, my parents were not, you know, they were second generation or first generation Americans, right? Their parents had come over from Russia, and then so they were first generation Americans. They were born here. And they didn't know how the system worked, in the sense, you know, they never told me, it's who you know. And you know what? It's who you know.
Yeah.
And that's just flat out the truth. You have to have talent. Once the door opens, you have to be able to walk through it.
Absolutely.
You have, there's all that stuff. I'm not saying that that's not part of it and it's all just random luck. But it really is.
Mm.
Who did you meet? When I was in college, I remember we had a Friday night. They called it Friday afternoon. They'd bring in speakers. And I remember we were sitting in one of these things. I forget who the speaker was. He said, "Turn to your right. Turn to your left. Stay in the business long enough, one of those people will hire you." And that was sort of the way of saying it is who you know, and it is about networking. And of course, you want to hire people that you like and are friends with. And that's how I got a number of jobs. I mean, just look at that path. I got the job at Movie Time, which became E, because of a guy I went to college with who got hired to sort of be the on-air guy, and he wanted somebody to write and produce for him, so they brought me in. And then, you know, TV Nation, I met all those writer guys, and they're the ones who brought me into Mar, which connected me to Ariana. It's how it goes. And so that's why when my kids were trying to decide where to go to school, and I said, you know what? It's not this sort of, well, I'm going to be a social climber and I'm going to go meet. I said, go to a place where you're going to meet a lot of dynamic, creative, talented people who are going to do shit in their lives. And when they're doing shit, at some point they'll go, hey, you know what? I need some help. I would like somebody with your talent to help me with my thing, or vice versa, right?
And this is part of this emotional IQ, that we have to develop an ability to think strategically, be creative, recognize our uniqueness, and associate with other people who support us and we support them. There you go. Now you know.
Done.
Go off and do it, right?
Cured. So basically, during the time, I was always writing. To get back to your original question, I've always saw myself as a writer.
Yeah.
For a while there, I saw myself more as an editor. You know, I was helping edit other people's stuff. I was writing stuff, you know, here and there, but it wasn't my main thing.
Yeah.
And then I became an executive. and I was sort of, you know, building things and running things and, you know, making decisions.
Signing off,
yes. I was the salt and pepper haired fellow in the corner wearing the suit, because at HuffPost Live, you know, we had a great team. They've all gone on to do fantastic things. And the average age was, I think, 12, you know, of the people that I hired. So you needed the one guy in the corner who was, you know, wait a minute.
He looks like a grown-up.
Yeah, he's a grown-up. Let me go talk and complain to him. Hey, I'm pissed off. Oh, come talk to me. You know. So then, to get back to the real crux of it, after where I met you, so then at a certain point near the end, what I didn't know was the end, but would eventually be the end of my HuffPost run, Ariana said to me, you know what, because I was dabbling in on-camera stuff, just doing interviews and stuff, mm-hmm. and, you know, you're of the British, I know you're Australian, but the monarchy. So what is it called when the king gets to choose and has sex with the person, the wife, when they get married? There's a name for that.
I have no idea.
There's a name for it. I should write it down.
That's so good. I love the transition.
Remember in Braveheart?
Yeah.
The king comes in and then Mel doesn't want him to schtup his wife, and that becomes a whole thing.
Yeah.
So there's a name for that.
Okay.
Primogenitor something, right?
Oh, yes. Primogenitor.
I mean something like
that. Yes, yes, yes.
The right to schtup, I think, is the translation.
Gosh.
Anyway, so I had the right as the president of HuffPost Live to every now and then go, hey, you know what? I fucking love Robert Duvall. I'm going to interview him.
Right, okay.
We got an interview with Jon Stewart. I'm going to do it, you know. So I did some of that, and we won awards, and things were going great. And so Ariana said, you know, you're so good on camera. You should do more of that.
Yep.
And she knew that I had obviously written for Michael Moore. Mm. I'd been an on-camera performer on that show as well, on Michael Moore's show. And she's like, you should get back to that part of it, you know. So I created the HuffPost show. Mm. And ended up executive producing it and writing a lot of it. And so I was getting back to my writing and performing roots.
Yes.
And enjoyed that quite a bit. That's when we brought you in to do the voiceover on one of the segments that I wrote.
Yes.
Along with my team. And so for the last 4 years, I was commuting from Los Angeles to New York on a weekly basis. So on Monday, I would fly to New York, and I would work all week, and then Friday night, I'd fly back to LA, be with my family for 2 days, and then do it again.
Wow.
And I did that 35 weeks a year for 4 years, which is insane. It's bonkers. And it takes a toll on your psyche and your body, and you know, and I loved it while I was doing it, mm-hmm. and in many ways it was incredibly fulfilling because I got the best of both worlds. During the week it was dynamic. I was in New York, 100 people on the streets, all great, and then I'd come home and ride my bike on the beach mm-hmm. on the weekend and mm-hmm. head back, you know, but it takes a bit of a toll. Mm-hmm. And so my daughter had 2 years left of high school, and I was always there for the big stuff, but I felt I wasn't there on the day-to-day stuff. And I really felt that I was missing something important. And so I decided to pull the ripcord. And after 17 years with Ariana and 11 years with HuffPost, tremendously successful, really great, I decided to just take the leap into the unknown and stop abusing my body. I could tell you the long story, but basically two things happened. One, I went to my doctor for a checkup. He said, you're in fantastic shape, but I would like you to stop flying so much and, you know, get your circadian rhythms on something that was a little bit normal. And I said, well, you know, I'm thinking of taking a year off. What do you think of that? He goes, could you do that? And I said, I think I could. He goes, well, here's my professional opinion. Why the fuck would you not do that? And I said, okay. And then the other thing was I had an experience where I drove my daughter to school one day, which I rarely did because I wasn't here during the week that often. And we had this wonderful conversation in the car. She was stressed about something. I gave her some fatherly advice. It actually helped. She felt a lot better about things. She got out of the car and said, Dad, I'm so glad that you were here this morning. You really helped me a lot. And she got out of the car and I just started crying. I'm gonna start crying now. And she started crying and I just thought, I can't miss these things. Like, I'm here for the big stuff, but I'm missing these little moments, and I'm never going to get that back. So that's when I decided to leave.
Your life is in such shiny color. Do you know that?
Please, pray tell. I'd like to hear more.
Well, I don't know. We're kind of running out of time, but you know, there's this thing that you don't hide from anything, and you've had these moments. Many people, and like you, I must have interviewed 100,000 people in my working life, and that's not even counting the people at Ralph's that I talk to.
Of course, important.
Right, but many people, it's very easy in hindsight to create a narrative that fits their current existence. I can pick those people apart for their lack of authenticity in a heartbeat, and when I'm producing my own shows, I won't have them on the show, because nobody wants that. Nobody wants somebody who's come up with a fridge magnet of their life and wants to inspire people. Your story is the shiny, colourful thing that people take something away from, because you can... This is going to be a listen twice podcast, I think, because it's so easy to identify where you had a fork in the road and you took it. The fork, both forks, you went, you know, and that's so exciting. As we are running out of time, the book is hysterical. There are so many funny things in it that I wanted to talk about today, but stuff it, you just have to buy the book, which is called...
It's called Lax Self-Control, True Stories I Waited Until My Parents Died to Tell.
We're going to have a link on the page so that people can buy it.
Great.
Internationally, because we have an international audience, where does one...
Amazon, okay. You know, Amazon all across the globe, okay. Is the best place. Okay. It's available in hardback, paperback, Kindle, and audiobook. And I pictured you in my mind as I did the audiobook myself.
Oh, yes, that's wonderful.
I recorded it. And
for a minute there, I thought you were going to offer me a job.
Well, you know, it would have been great. You're my second choice.
It's not your book.
But I just thought, you know, because here's the thing. These are all true stories from my life. Mm. And that, I don't know if we're all out of time, but that's why when I took a year off, flashing back to that other year, I took a year off, hung out with my daughter, worked out, got sane again. Not that, you know, I'd gotten a little crazy,
just moved
off the rough edges. Didn't do anything. No creative work on purpose. I felt I needed to remove myself from those 11 years at HuffPost and 17 years. Who was I outside of that? So I did nothing. Even if a creative idea came into my head, I banished it.
Right.
Not going to do it. And after a year, I decided, you know what? I'm a creative fella, and I'd like to kind of get back to that. And I had no idea what I wanted to do. Mm. And so I thought, you know, there's always those funny stories that you tell over beers or at night, and, you know, you meet somebody new, and you're telling each other the funny things, and, you know. And I thought, well, I've told those. I've sort of told those over the years, so in that way I've edited them and polished them like you do a stand-up act, and you know where the laugh is, you know where the laugh's not, so you know, cut that crap out, that didn't work, you know, and punch that part up. And so I thought, if I start with that, since I've already told those stories, let's see what they're like when I write them on paper.
Right.
And maybe through that process I will discover my voice. And who my voice was outside of HuffPost, because I'd spent so many years. Mm. And so that's what I did. I started writing, and it just poured out of me. It was like a dam being burst, you know, because I had not done anything for a year. And I just was on fire. And I was just writing all the time, desperately trying to keep up with my brain, which was like the synapses were firing left and right. So I was just trying to have my fingers keep up with it. And I like writing. I actually like the process of writing. Many people don't. You know, there's a famous expression, you know, I hate writing, I love having written. But I actually like the process of playing with words and sentences and evocative images. And so that's what this book is, really. It was really, this poured out of me, and I had two goals. And I think it relates back to what you were saying, and I appreciate what you said. One was, I wanted to be as funny as I was capable of being, because I just wanted to be funny. Mm. I think we need a lot of that in this world,
yeah.
You know? I thought it was really something that we all need more of, is laughs. And be as honest as possible. That's something else we need.
They're the two things that struck me.
Yeah.
You've achieved it. I hope you sell a gazillion copies.
I so appreciate that, and I've enjoyed talking with you very much.
Thank you, Roy Seekoff.
Absolutely.
Go and buy the book. The link is going to be on the page.
Fantastic.
You've been listening to Take Fountain with Ella James. For more, like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to the podcast at Audio Boom, Stitcher, iTunes, or your favorite podcasting app. This has been another quality podcast production from Bytes.com.